The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Again, it's Tuesday, and welcome back wherever you are, all around this besieged and beleaguered planet. It's a struggle almost everywhere you look, and it's unfortunately only going to get worse because the global elite, or whatever you want to call them, have planned it this way. Nothing is happening coincidentally or by accident. It's all a plan. And my first guest tonight, who will be with us for 2 hours, has written a book, and we're going to talk about this book. I'll give you the title. It is The Deliberate Destruction of America and the World. Who's Doing It and Why? By Dr. Lorraine Day, MD. And it's got everything in it, 800 pages. And these are full-size pages, 8.5 by 11. It's one of the most unique books of our time. It is out now. In addition to all of Lorraine's many other books, DVDs and videos and things, she has a great page, drday.com. You can go there anytime, 24/7, and help yourself to incredible amounts of knowledge and wisdom brought together by many decades of professional medical, I won't even say expertise, I'll say ethics. How's that? Now, Lorraine and I go way back. I was thinking about this earlier today, and it's at least 25 years. I've been doing this program 28 years. However, Lorraine Day has been doing her thing for even longer than that. And it's always nice to talk to her. She's an incredible resource. And Lorraine, are you there?
I'm here. Good evening. Can you hear me?
I do. Good evening.
Good.
And you know, how long has it been since you were first on? 25 years? Something like that.
At least, I think. Yeah, 25 years, or probably.
Maybe 45. Who's counting? I don't know. It's crazy out there. I think your book is extraordinary. I haven't read it. I would love to get a hold of it, and maybe I will if I only had the time. But I want to start out with something that I think will be just perfect for you to dive into. And that's this new second coming, so to speak, of HIV. And here are three headlines real quick, just off the news this evening. Routine HIV testing is now being done at doctor office visits. But there's no need, apparently, to test for HIV if you're unvaxxed. So they're testing the vaxxed for HIV. Headline one. Headline two, mainstream media says vaxxed people should take HIV drugs to lower their COVID risk. That's a headline. Here's the third one. Let me find the third one. Where did it go? Oh, well, it's there somewhere. I'll find it later. There are story after story after story. Three fully vaxxed cyclists in Europe suffer major heart attacks. Two are dead. Athletes, another soccer player dropped over dead in Europe. It just goes on and on. But this HIV thing is being rolled out, in my view, to give the big pharma ghouls some cover as to why everyone's immune system, who have been double and triple vaxxed, is beginning to collapse. They got to blame something. Mm-hmm. They don't want people looking at, maybe it was that shot. No, it's HIV. And if you look online, and I think you probably have, and you simply type in HIV test kits or HIV home test kits, my goodness, they're all over the place. They're ready for this. It's all been planned. It's all been rolled out. And with that, Dr. Day, I turn the floor over to you. Let's go.
Well, thank you. First, let me give the listeners my background, because I was probably the most outspoken opponent of the government and the CDC on the AIDS epidemic way back in the late 80s and early 90s. I was chief of orthopedic surgery at that time at San Francisco General Hospital. AIDS exploded in San Francisco. I was also vice chairman of the department and associate professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. And I was the highest ranking academic surgeon speaking out about the AIDS epidemic. And I was featured on many, many programs. I was on CNN, Crossfire, Oprah Winfrey, Larry King Live, and over 1,000 radio shows, and eventually featured on 60 Minutes. I was asked to come to speak to the Royal Society of Medicine in England. They asked me to come down to Australia and speak to all the heads of the orthopedic meetings in Sydney. They brought them from all over the country of Australia. I just want to set the stage that I was in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, because I'm going to give you startling information tonight, startling that you've never heard before. And so I have to set the stage for this. My risk of getting AIDS was estimated by the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. In about 1989, it was estimated that my risk was greater than 50% of getting AIDS, because I was operating on so many AIDS patients or high-risk patients for AIDS. There were times at San Francisco General Hospital that 90% of the patients I was operating on were either known AIDS patients or high-risk or HIV-positive patients. I did this for 9 years. The epidemic started in 1991. The CDC kept telling us that drug addicts could get AIDS from needles, but surgeons could not, and healthcare workers could not get AIDS from needles,
One quickie. Was 1991 the official start of the AIDS epidemic?
1981.
That's what I thought you meant to say. Okay, I just want to be clear on that.
That's what I thought I said. 1981, yeah. 1981.
Because you remember, I put together a book. It wasn't anything like yours. It was a big book on AIDS, and that was 1989. So I was right there, and you were incredible. You were all over the news, all over the world, talking to everyone, and literally putting yourself at highest risk of a non-sexual nature in the medical profession in your work. You saw things. You used to tell me stories that I couldn't believe about working in ER and emergency surgery procedures. Just astonishing stories. Go ahead.
Well, the orthopedic surgeons do the bloodiest surgery, because we work on bleeding bone and we have very large wounds, and we're working with high-speed power equipment, high-speed saws, We're working with wires and all things that then can cut through our gloves and into our hands. So we are the most at risk, and you cannot stop bone bleeding. You can tie off vessels in soft tissue, but you cannot stop bone bleeding. So we were covered with blood all the time. Blood would spray onto our faces before we started wearing face shields, plastic mm-hmm. face shields, and right. So we were covered with blood. There was one patient that had been shot multiple times, a young man, and the body holds 8 pints of blood, uh-huh. and I replaced 233 units of blood in this young man because pints? It all came out all over us on the floor. Okay,
these are pints. Is a unit? Is a unit a pint?
Well, that's what they call it. It's about a pint. A unit is about
okay.
a pint.
And how many
and so
was that?
The body contained 233.
Phew.
The body contains 8, but it just kept pouring out of him because he had so many wounds. So mm-hmm. and it just flows all over us. I even got in trouble with the blood bank because they said you used up all our blood on one patient, but the patient survived. So it was uh-huh. it was good. But I mean, that's the kind of blood we have all over us. We would have blood on our feet, sometimes up to our knees. When I would go out after an operation to talk to the patient's family, I would have to go into the women's dressing room and put my feet and legs under the shower, so I would not be covered with blood and frighten the family. So that's the kind of blood that we had on us. And all the time, the Centers for Disease Control was telling us, you're not at risk. What's wrong with you? Why are you concerned? While they sat in their offices with white shirts and ties and not yeah. getting any blood on them. Okay. So, and I was very concerned because my risk that I was told, even by the CDC, was as high as a promiscuous homosexual of getting AIDS just from the work I was doing operating on AIDS patients. Mm-hmm. And so after doing this for 9 years, I decided to hang it up because nobody keeps somebody on the front lines of the battlefield for 9 years without giving them some respite. So my children, my young sons, were concerned that I would get AIDS and then I would come home and give AIDS to them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I left the university in 1990, and I had recently been divorced and I got remarried again in Southern California. But all during this time, as I was speaking out about the government, I had my life threatened many, many times. Even at San Francisco General, there were times that the hospital administrator, just because I was telling the truth about what the government was doing and not doing mm-hmm. about AIDS, they would have armed guards in the operating room with me. So we'd have men in scrubs with guns, okay? And then,
wow.
of course, after I moved to Southern California, right where I'm sitting right now, for 5 years, almost every week, there would be a black unmarked helicopter hanging over my house, shaking it so violently that one time they actually shattered a floor-to-ceiling sliding glass door. So,
wow.
you know,
wow.
my life has not been a quiet just because I was telling the truth. But I want to set the stage because I was so concerned about AIDS, and AIDS was told to us by the CDC it was a transmissible disease, it was transmissible by blood, and then the HIV virus was supposedly isolated. Gallo and Luc Montagnier sort of shared the spotlight on this. One of them got the Nobel Prize or something, and they said they had isolated the HIV virus and HIV was the cause of AIDS.
Don't okay. forget Fauci. Fauci and Gallo were in it, and Montagnier
right.
and his assistant actually shared the Nobel. But Fauci was right in there
right.
cheek by jowl with Gallo, so
right.
it was
and,
quite a war.
And Gallo and right, and Gallo apparently fraudulently stole, Montagnier had apparently sent him the virus, and mm-hmm. then he claimed it for his own. So there was a lot of skullduggery going on there. But
yep.
here is the very interesting part of this. In 1996, Peter Duisberg, who was a virologist at UC Berkeley, wrote a book Now, in 1996, I did not know that he wrote this book because I was struggling to stay alive. I had fourth-stage cancer at that time. I was bedridden. I had been sick for 3.5 years. And so I was trying desperately to reverse my cancer. And I eventually did by totally natural methods, and that's been 29 years since my diagnosis. But at the time that this book came out in 1996, I did not know about it because I was doing other things, as I said.
Sure.
But I have recently read that book, and the title of the book is Inventing the AIDS Virus. Now, I'm sure that you and your listeners have all heard of Terry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for the PCR test.
Yes.
Terry Mullis has said repeatedly the PCR test does not test for anything. It doesn't test for any virus. It does not test for any virus.
What it doesn't test for clinical infections. That's what it doesn't do.
What it does is it only it multiplies the number of particles that are there, so you can then test what is there with another test. It is like a chemical copy machine, such as if you have a murder victim that has touch DNA on their shirt, but it's not enough to test to find out whose DNA it is. You first use a PCR, which magnifies or multiplies the number of particles that are there. So then you can test whose DNA it is with another test. So the PCR does not test for anything. The PCR was supposedly used to test for HIV, except it doesn't. The PCR has been used to test for COVID-19, except it doesn't.
Right.
And Terry Mullis is the one who developed the test. And he's the one that says it doesn't test for it. Now, Terry Mullis, conveniently for Fauci and others, passed away just a few months before the beginning of the COVID pandemic.
3 months.
Terry Mullis, yes, Terry Mullis had been asking Fauci to come to his area for them to debate because Terry Mullis said Fauci doesn't know anything. And so it was convenient for all of these people when Kerry Mullis passed away. Whether there was any underhanded business going on, I do not know. But so he's gone, but he made it very clear that the PCR cannot be used to test for a virus.
You can see videos of him making exactly that statement, as you know. It's online.
Yes.
You all can look for it. Mullis, M-U-L-L-I-S.
Right.
Just look it up and look at the videos. He was very clear about it.
Right. So all of this business of using the PCR for COVID-19 is a sham. They cannot tell whether or not anybody has COVID-19 by testing with the PCR, which is the polymerase chain reaction. Okay. Now, that's a very important point. Now, the other thing I must say is I used to believe that vaccinations, routine vaccinations, I was just as brainwashed as every other doctor and every other person, you know, the smallpox vaccine, the measles vaccine, I believed that they worked. And in fact, in 1989, I got a hepatitis B vaccination because so many of these AIDS patients supposedly also had hepatitis B, and I was operating on them. I want you to know, all of you listening, that I was a believer. I was a believer. Well, it turns out that vaccinations of every kind have never worked. The other thing you should know is that they used to say, and they still say, that the way they would find out whether a vaccine worked was if it gave you antibodies to that particular virus or whatever they were vaccinating you for. So when they would do the testing, if they would give you the vaccination and you developed antibodies, then that was good because those antibodies would protect you.
Sure.
However, with AIDS, when you supposedly got AIDS, they would test for the antibodies, And if you had the antibodies, they said, then you needed treatment. So it was the opposite of what they said for every other disease. Antibodies supposedly protect you. But with AIDS, when you had HIV antibodies or AIDS antibodies, they didn't protect you. So you see, they were already turning everything upside down. Now, yeah. There's another thing that we must consider to set the stage for what I'm going to tell you.
Oh, and one quick thing, if I might. This is important. And if you were determined to have AIDS, HIV, the treatment they gave you would just about guarantee your immune system would collapse, as you know.
AZT.
That's right. Fauci's favorite.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Now, AZT was a drug that was developed for chemotherapy for cancer patients, but was found to be so toxic that they could not even use it on cancer patients.
Right.
Now, that is really saying something, because all chemotherapy agents are toxic, very toxic. They cause you destruction of your immune system. You see, what doctors are telling patients, if you have cancer, in order to make you well, we first have to make you terribly, terribly sick. But that doesn't make any sense. But that's what they do. You see, they know that chemotherapy and radiation both cause cancer. But why would they give it to you when you already have cancer? See, you see, everything is backwards. Everything is a lie. And so when we were discussing this whole business of AIDS, I want to tell you that I was in medical school 55 years ago. And at that time, we never heard anything about the microbiome. Doctors didn't know anything about the microbiome. The microbiome is the large amount of bacteria you have in your intestine that are your friends.
We've got to go through the break, Todd. No break. Thank you. About 7 pounds per adult in the digestive tract of bacteria.
That's
friends.
Right. About 100 trillion bacteria you have in your intestine, which are 33% of your immune system. Those bacteria make vitamin K, vitamin B12. They are part of your immune system. They are your friends. Now, there are 30,000 different types of bacteria that they know about. However, isn't it interesting that less than 100 of them cause disease? 30,000 different types.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 100 cause disease. So how can you tell a good bacteria from a bad bacteria? Well, they don't really know. So here's what they say. When you eat wrong, when you are stressed, when you don't get enough sleep, when you do many things that destroy your immune system, it doesn't really make you sick. What it does is it affects the bacteria so they turn on you. So you don't make yourself sick. What you do is you cause the bacteria to turn on you. Well, this is nonsense. This is
the good bacteria. The good bacteria.
Right.
Turn
the
on
good
you.
Bacteria turn on you.
You see? Okay.
Science
fiction.
Well, the way you make yourself sick is not getting enough sleep, being too stressed. If you look at the side effects, when you are stressed from any reason, financial stress, domestic stress, work stress, whatever stress, you trigger your fight or flight reaction, which pours two hormones into your body, adrenaline and cortisol. Cortisol is like prednisone, cortisone. There are over 100 side effects, massive side effects to both of those drugs. God has given us that ability to have immense energy to run out of a house during a fire, a woman to lift up a car off of her child who's under it, or to run from a bear, or run from an attack or something like that. But it's meant for very short term. But when people are stressed all the time, they are pouring adrenaline and cortisol into their body constantly. doctors are always scratching their heads saying, we don't know if stress causes disease. Well, if you look at the side effects of adrenaline and cortisone, there's over a hundred horrible side effects of both of those drugs. A six-year-old could say, of course, if you are stressed, you're going to give yourself disease. All right? Mm-hmm. So now they're saying, well, you don't give yourself disease. What you do is it affects these bacteria and they turn on you. Well, the answer is the bacteria are always your friends. And you see, the other thing is when you see a huge house fire and you see firemen there, the firemen did not cause the fire. They are there to fix it. When you see a massive accident on the freeway and you see paramedics there, they did not cause the accident. They're there to take care of the injured. When you see rats and flies at a garbage pile, they did not cause the garbage. They are there to eat up the mess. But when doctors see bacteria in an area of disease, they say, voila, that's what caused it. That's like saying the firemen caused the fire, the paramedics caused the accident, and the rats caused the garbage. But when you see bacteria in an area of disease, they are there to clean up the mess. God has given us scavengers on the earth. We have vultures. Uh-huh. We have rats and pigs and all that. They are there to eat up the mess. If we didn't have scavenger animals, then the earth would be covered with all the dead animals and all the waste material that has ever been. So God gave us scavenger animals. God gave us scavengers in our body, too, and they're called bacteria and fungi. Those are the scavengers that eat up the dead and dying tissue that we cause by the way we live, think, act, eat, and handle stress. They are not our enemies. They are our friends. And let me repeat again, just because they're there does not mean they cause the problem. They are there to fix the problem. So where do these bacteria come from? Where does the microbiome come from? Well, they say when a baby is born and it comes through the birth canal, it gets the bacteria from the mother's birth canal, and that's how it makes its microbiome. Well, then you say, well, what if a baby is born by cesarean section? Where does it get its microbiome? Oh, well, then it gets its microbiome from breastfeeding. Okay? Well, then what if a baby is born by C-section but does not breastfeed for some reason? Where does it get its microbiome? We don't know. Well, it turns out that our body can actually make bacteria. The body makes bacteria and yeast. And this was discovered 150 years ago by Antoine Beauchamp, who was the antagonist of Louis Pasteur. Louis Pasteur was the one who came up with the germ theory. And let me make that very clear that it's still a theory. And the theory has been proven wrong. But everybody loves bacteria and viruses. Because, first of all, particularly viruses, the evolutionists love viruses because they say, well, a virus is alive. No, they're not alive. Oh, yes, they are alive. No, they're not alive. Oh, they are the bridge between non-living and living things in evolution. So the evolutionists love the idea of a virus.
If I might say one thing, and excuse me. The microbiome you brought up, very critical information that most, honestly, the average person on the street doesn't have a clue about. They just don't know. They don't even know what's inside of them. So you go to a doctor, and he says, ah, the friendly bacteria have turned on you. They're your enemy. They're making you sick. And what do? They put you on heavy-duty antibiotics, and they wipe out most all of the microbiome in your digestive tract. And you, good luck trying to rebuild it. Some people say you can never fully rebuild it. It's wiped out. But the doctors won't tell you that. They won't tell you about probiotics or how to repopulate. Go ahead.
Well, but see, the thing is, what they do tell you, go buy the bacteria from a cow. okay, the probiotics, okay? Get them from a cow or get them from a drug company laboratory or something like that, you see. But the thing is that we can actually make our own microbiome. We can replenish it. You're absolutely right that antibiotics wipe it out. Because anti-bio means against life. That's what an antibiotic is. It destroys life, and it destroys your microbiome, which you need to stay healthy. So then they tell you, oh, well, then go buy it from a drugstore, which is made either from a cow or from a laboratory. But the whole point is Antoine Beauchamp, way back 150 years ago, said, you can make your own bacteria. The microorganism that turns into a bacterium is called, he called it a microzyma. Microzyma, and then Gaston Naissons just much more recently said the same thing. These are only seen under a dark field microscope. Gaston Naissons called them somatids. I actually visited Gaston Naissons in Canada a number of years ago and spent a whole afternoon with him in his laboratory. He was showing me all this. You can see them under a dark field microscope. You cannot see them under a light microscope or under an electron microscope. Doctors never use a dark field microscope.
It's one of the biggest things that I cannot still to this day accept. How can a conscientious, intelligent, moral, well-trained physician not have access to one in the office? I don't get
it. They don't even know about them. They don't even know about them. They're called quackery. They're called quackery because the drug companies do not want anyone to know that you can replenish your own microbiome, because these somatids actually go in a cycle of three until you have diseased or dying tissue in your body caused by your lifestyle factors, the way you live, think, act, eat, and handle stress. Then when you develop disease, the somatids will turn into whatever is necessary, a cocci or a rod bacteria or a fungus that can go and clean up the mess. And so that is well known by alternative doctors who can look through dark field microscopes and see these somatids or microzyma, that's the same thing, moving around and turning into these other types of bacteria and fungus. I saw that with my own eyes when I visited Gaston Naissons.
That's a remarkable thing.
About 30 years ago.
You got to do that. Yes. That's amazing. This reminds me of Royal Rife, who could see somatids and pleomorphism in his brilliant microscopes in the 1920s. So
that's
this goes way back.
He thought bacteria actually caused the disease.
I understand.
So, by the way, when I was sick, I tried the Rife generator. I also tried 714X of Gaston Naissons. I tried ozone. I tried all of these things. I tried over 40 different types of alternatives. None of them worked. I got well by just changing everything that God tells us to change about our lifestyle, because the cure for cancer is actually in the Bible in Deuteronomy 7:11-15. God says, if you follow my laws, and that includes all of his health laws, my commandments and my decrees, I will keep you free from every disease. And that is the way I got well, by changing everything about my life, because I tried all of these other alternatives and none of them worked. So anyway, what we have to look at is how orthodox medicine, you see, the Rockefellers way back in the late 1800s, John D. Rockefeller had laws passed with Abraham Flexner and with Morris Fishbein to eliminate all natural healing from every medical school. And they brought in drug medicine, because at that time, John D. Rockefeller was the controller and owner of Standard Oil, and petroleum products are used to make many drugs. And so this was the plan, to eliminate all natural healing, which is the way things were done for hundreds of years before that, you see. And so then drugs came in, and that's all doctors know how to do. All a doctor knows how to do is give you a drug that will never get you well, because drugs don't cure disease. They only treat symptoms, or they'll cut off your body parts or cut out your organs. Well, I developed breast cancer. I didn't have to be a rocket scientist to realize I didn't develop breast cancer because I had too many breasts. So cutting one or the both of them off was not going to cure me. So I did not have that done. And that's why I was sick for so long, trying to figure out how to get well, and I finally did and got well. So the microbiome, again, is your friend. And so these are bacteria. There are not 100 of them that turn on you. None of them turn on you. Bacteria do not cause disease. Bacteria are there to clean up the mess. Now let's talk about viruses. Where did viruses come from, and when did they discover viruses? It turns out that the first virus study was done about in the late 1800s. And what they did, they looked at tobacco leaves that were infected. And right. So they wanted to find out if it was a bacteria. So they ground up the leaves, and they filtered it through a filter that would filter out all the bacteria. By the way, bacteria are hundreds of times larger than what they call a virus. And so they filtered it, and they got anything out that would be a bacteria. And they took that substance that was left and put it on uninfected tobacco leaves, and they became infected. So they said what was in the solution that they put on the other leaves that caused the infection was a poison. Now, a poison is much different from a microorganism. A poison is like strychnine, or a poison is like drinking, what do they put, the fluid in your car. You know, if you want to poison somebody, you give them,
sure, it's antifreeze. It's cooler.
Antifreeze. So that's a poison. That is not a microorganism. A microorganism is something that can reproduce itself. It is alive. Okay? So they said it is a poison. Okay?
Right.
But the word poison in Latin is the word virus.
Ah, interesting.
That's how they got there. So a poison miraculously morphed into a supposed microorganism, except that what they're calling a virus is just a piece of DNA with a protein coat around it. It cannot reproduce itself outside the body at all. It cannot. A bacteria can, but a virus cannot. That's why a virus is not alive. Now, they're talking about in the COVID pandemic, all of these sanitation things, oh, use this fluid, it will kill the virus, except a virus is not alive. How can you kill a rock? You can't kill something that's not alive. Viruses, what they're calling viruses, are just pieces of DNA. Now, the whole
covered with
with a protein coat.
Okay. Can they?
Protein coat. Now,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
Now, it turns out that when DNA reproduces itself, it will cover itself with a protein coat in order to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
So DNA will protect itself with either with methylation or histones or protein coat. So then you have to say, well, what are these pieces of DNA? It turns out what they're calling a virus is just dead cell debris. Cells die all the time. A red blood cell will live about 3 months. A white blood cell sometimes lives only 3 to 4 weeks. When the white blood cell dies, then its membrane ruptures and the DNA falls out. That's what they're calling a virus. And then when the bacteria come and eat that up, then they call it a bacteriophage. And they say, the viruses are infecting the bacteria. No, the bacteria are eating up the dead cell debris.
The garbage.
Okay.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. So the whole point is, if we go back to the number one study, the largest study, medical study ever done in the history of the world, included over 1 million people. 1 million people. And that was during the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt. The physician who was head of that was God himself. In the Bible, there are 549 verses on sanitation laws for the Exodus. Because they were living in a large community, they were living in these large tents, they didn't have the sanitation like we have now. So right. God gave them all these sanitation laws so they would be healthy. Okay? So if anybody had a discharge from their body and anybody touched it, they would be considered unclean for a period of time. And he told them how they had to wash their clothes and wash themselves. So I want everybody to listen very carefully. Of the 549 texts in the Bible giving the sanitation laws by God himself for 1 million Israelites, and I have read them all twice, there is not one sanitation law to protect them from a disease spread through the air. Not one.
So no aerosolization worries, nothing written about it at all.
You cannot spread disease through the air. Or God would have given them some laws to protect themselves from that.
He would have given them N95 masks. That's what he would have done.
Right. So you can spread toxins on your hands. Like if you have a restaurant worker who goes to the bathroom, does not wash his or her hands, and contaminates the food, you can get food poisoning. Mm-hmm. But you cannot spread diseases through the air.
Just for our listeners... Lorraine, just for our listeners, how would you define food poisoning? What causes food poisoning? Go ahead.
Toxins. And when you have waste material, whether the waste material is fecal, urine, or a discharge someplace from the body, it contains toxins. And when you have, suppose you have a dead body or a dead animal, it produces putrescine, cadaverine. That is what causes the decay of the body. We have dead cells in our body. We eliminate waste. Those are toxins. Now, there are bacteria in that, but the bacteria are not the ones causing the disease. They're there to clean up the mess. It is the toxins that cause the disease. When we are stressed, our body produces substance called cytokines, which produce inflammation, which causes breakdown of tissue. When tissues start to break down, then you produce toxins. Okay? It is the toxins that cause the disease, not the bacteria, and certainly not the virus, which is dead cell debris. And again, with 549 texts, there is not one sanitation law to protect them from airborne diseases. Not one. Okay.
Interesting.
That's from God himself. So therefore, there are no diseases that can be transmitted through the air. Now, when they started this searching for viruses, they got a virus, because then, you see, as I told you, everybody loves viruses. The evolutionists love it because they think, this is the bridge between non-living and living things. The drug companies love it because we can make endless viruses. By the way, I told you there are 30,000 different types of bacteria, but they say less than 100 cause disease. Do you know how many viruses there are? There are a quadrillion. That's from the medical literature. Quadrillion, more than the stars in the sky. And yet, only 219 cause disease.
This is in the medical literature.
Quadrillion, but only 219 cause disease. But they don't. That is the interesting thing. Now, the other interesting thing is when Terry Mullis was starting, we talked about him earlier, when he was starting to write articles about HIV, he started saying, well, who has isolated HIV? So he started talking to his colleagues, and they said, well, you don't have to worry about that. Everybody knows that HIV is the cause of AIDS. He says, well, give me the article that shows that. To make a long story short, he never found an article showing that HIV causes AIDS, because HIV doesn't do anything. HIV does not do anything. What killed the patients was the AZT. Now, this has happened before, as Duesberg points out in his book. In Japan, they had a disease that was called NSOM. It was for this particular disease, and it turned out after 11 years of people dying, and over 11 or 12,000 were affected by the disease, and I can't remember how many thousands died, they found out that they were dying from the drugs that they were being given to treat them. That's just the same thing that happened with AIDS. When a person was found to supposedly be HIV positive with a PCR test that didn't test for anything, they put them on AZT, and the AZT killed them.
AZT was one of the biggest criminal acts I've ever seen. As you know, and you've already stated it, just to rehash this, AZT was a failed chemotherapy drug that was put on the shelf, and then, oh, well, we've got this drug here. This is what we need for HIV. Fauci was involved up to his eyeballs.
Right.
They pulled it off the shelf. They began giving it to people. What does AZT primarily do? It destroys the bone marrow, the base of your entire immunological system.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So very clever, huh? They get rich killing people. Well, they're still at it, Lorraine. They haven't stopped.
Of course. That's right. That's exactly what they're doing now. So when they talk about people having AIDS, what does AIDS stand for? It stands for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. All that means is that you have a suppressed immune system that you weren't born with. In other words, you acquired the suppression of your immune system sometime in later life. You were not born with a suppressed immune system. You acquired it in some way. Now, cancer is an acquired immune deficiency syndrome. You cannot develop cancer unless your immune system is suppressed by the way you're living, eating, and handling stress. Now, one of the biggest things that suppressed the immune system in the homosexuals was the nitrates they were using. They're nitrites and nitrates they were using. They were using poppers, which were a lot of
amyl,
drugs, which were
amyl nitrate.
Amyl nitrate.
Yeah.
And they were, and which was very destructive to the immune system. And
right.
They were having numerous partners, hundreds of partners a year. And in the bathhouses, they were spreading fecal material everywhere. When they would come in, and I was in San Francisco, I took care of homosexuals long before AIDS came along. They had many diseases because of their self-destructive practices that they were doing, okay? This was destroying their immune system, not only the drugs, but the numerous sexual partners. And the other thing that people don't know about, and that Duesberg does not know about and never mentions in his book, which I have in my book called Who Wants Homosexuals Dead? I wrote that book in about 2010, and I show the reason I named it that controversial way is that everyone who promotes homosexuality wants them dead because it's a very self-destructive lifestyle. And I show how it is so self-destructive. And the medical literature shows that when semen is deposited in the rectum, whether in a male or female, it suppresses the immune system.
It takes it right down.
Duesberg does not ever mention that, but that is a well-known medical fact. Duesberg is not a medical doctor. He's a PhD. And so he did not know that. But we knew that all along. And this is well documented in the medical literature. So these people, and of course drug addicts, were constantly injecting with drugs and all different kinds of drugs and destroying their immune system as well. And so when they would find HIV, which you can find in almost anybody, and they were even diagnosing AIDS without HIV, and they extended the symptoms for AIDS to include almost everything in a telephone book. If you had TB, if you had cachexia, which means if you were skeletal because you were losing weight, if you had nausea, diarrhea, if you had whatever symptom you had, they called it AIDS. And that's what they did in Africa. They had this huge epidemic, they said, in Africa. Most of those people were not even HIV positive. So they called it AIDS and they gave them AZT and they killed them.
Oh, they made a lot of money. Oh, yes.
Of course. But the money is secondary. The population extermination is primary.
That's the nut. That's what the whole injection with the smallpox vaccine in Africa was about, and the hepatitis B vaccine program here in those 10 American cities, restricted to promiscuous homosexuals, we might add. So that's how they laced it in the populations and watched.
Well,
it was a big
experiment. If you go back all the way to the smallpox epidemic, it turns out that there was no smallpox epidemic. It was the vaccinations that killed them. The swine flu, it was the vaccinations. The Hong Kong flu, it was the vaccinations. Bird flu, it was the vaccinations. It has always been that. With the swine flu, they could never find anybody with swine flu.
Yeah, I have to take a break for a few minutes. So one quickie here. There's an avian influenza outbreak in this country, which I believe is clearly created to hasten and exacerbate the coming food shortages.
Right.
They're wiping out millions upon millions of chickens, and they're using to determine, guess what they're losing? They're using to determine avian influenza among chickens. The PCR test.
PCR, right.
There you go.
Exactly.
So, okay,
hold on
a minute. Dr. Lorraine Day and I will be right back. drday.com. Her new book is there. All her materials are there, brilliantly put together. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hang on.